Good morning, and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I am, as most of you know, Sandy Ingham, Prairie's minister. Prairie tries to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure, we welcome you. No matter your age, or your inabilities, or your abilities, color of your hair, color of your eyes, we welcome you. Later in the service, we will have an opportunity to, or you will have an opportunity to introduce yourself if this is your first time or one of your first times. And I always encourage people to come more than once to see what we're all about, because sometimes I do the service, sometimes people from within the congregation do the service, and sometimes those from, we have a guest speaker from outside. I bring you greetings from your Transylvanian Unitarian brothers and sisters. You will hear much more about this in the coming months. This morning's collection will go to the Literacy Network of Madison, and that is described in your order of service. What they do is described. The opening words are these. Let us come into a calm, clear place where we can relinquish our clutter and relax from busyness into being. Let us settle into that calm, clear place where the earth supports our bodies and the community lifts our spirits, where we can breathe in peace and center ourselves in love. Let us welcome our calm, clear place where our hearts can open and our thoughts can expand beyond the cobwebs of convention into the creative flow of infinity. We light the flame of knowledge. May understanding be with us. We light the flame of love. May caring be among us. We light the flame of holiness. May the unifying spirit be within us. The reading this morning is taken from a speech that Unitarian Universalist minister and then president of Star King School for the Ministry, Rebecca Parker, gave right after Katrina. Rebecca writes, "What we need is a revolution in our values, a revolution that turns our attention more reverently and responsibly to the interdependent relational character of life. What we need is a spiritual and practical revolution, spiritual and practical, that embodies love for neighbor and for the world through sustaining structures of care and responsibility." 5 days after the hurricane, President Bush toured some of the devastation in Louisiana, Alabama, and Mississippi, and said this was a time for people to love their neighbors as themselves. His comment suggests a view of love as a gesture of kindly help when the situation has become horrendously dire. Such a view of love is not sufficient. Loving our neighbor implicates us in loving the whole network of life. This interconnectedness of all things calls for wisdom and reverence. Maybe in the end, Parker says, love will save us all. But it has a lot better chance at the beginning. We need to love from the start, not as an emergency strategy when everything has gone wrong, we must learn again to live with reverence. Reverence is a form of love. It is a response to life that falls on its knees before the rising sun and bows down before the mountains. It puts its palms together in the presence of the night sky and the myriad galaxies and recognizes, as poet Langston Hughes tells us, beautiful are the stars, beautiful too are the faces of my people. Reverence greets all humanity as sacred. Reverence for life has to be learned. It is not just a feeling. It's a way of life that is manifested in more than an isolated moment of appreciation for nature or awe before its destructive or creative power. Reverence involves full-fledged devotion, enacted in deeds of care and responsibility. It involves knowledge, study, and attention. Our society is currently guided by a worldview that is insufficiently grounded in reverence, writes Parker. Religiously, it is a worldview that regards the earth itself as trash. Economically, the dominant worldview regards human beings as self-interested individuals, motivated only by their personal desire to consume. And scientifically, it sees existence as devoid of value, atomistic, disconnected, and mechanistic. Such inadequate views are tearing our world to tatters by lack of regard for the communal character of life. A few years ago, Parker says, when I visited my congregation's partner church in Oakland, Transylvania, Reverend Levente Kellerman took me into the sanctuary to see the ceiling of the 400-year-old Unitarian church in his village. An aside, these churches don't look like this. They don't look like First Unitarian either. They look like a traditional big cathedral with the steeple, bells, the whole works. So here's Rebecca in this room. She writes, in typical Transylvanian style, the church has a wooden ceiling crisscrossed with beams, creating a lattice of deep squares, which are painted with folk art, depicting flowers and plants. They're beautiful. It's bright. Near the center of the sanctuary, the ceiling harbors a surprising image, a golden sun surrounded by circling planets in a star-spangled indigo sky. It is a diagram of the Copernican solar system. At a time when religion was opposing science, our ancestors in the remote mountains and valleys of Transylvania built sanctuaries that affirmed the discoveries of science. They did so even when the dominant religious culture advocated ideologies that allowed no new revelation and insisted that the old theories of how the world came to be had to be taught in the public schools. Our task now is to do what we can to advance reverence for life and deepen the promise of love. Let us make love the first, not the last, resort. I too saw wooden ceilings in some of those old Transylvanian Unitarian churches. Just a week ago today, I was in one in the village of Nojota for the Sunday morning service. The village has about 300 or 400 people. All of these villages have Unitarian churches. In Transylvania, most of the villages are 50% Catholic and 50% Unitarian. The Unitarian Church in Nojota is over 500 years old. The experience was overwhelming. To think that a small group of free thinkers could have so much influence on the world, not only in the 1500s, but still, now, today, what they did and how they thought influences us greatly. To think that many of these people were willing to go to prison for their beliefs, willing to lose everything when they stated publicly such beliefs as these. While they believed that the Bible was a book full of great wisdom, they did not believe it was meant to be taken literally. We're in the mid-1500s here. And this one, the Bible was not the only religious book of wisdom in the world. Our Transylvanian ancestors arrived, as you might think they would, and similar to the way that most of us arrive at important conclusions, they determined their theological beliefs and conclusions through the use of reason and rational thinking. But there was one more element in their processing, in their bag of tricks, so to speak. These early Unitarians had a profound reverence for life, a reverence that was passionate. They were passionate about their right to freedom of thought, passionate about examining new ways of thinking, using the then new methods of science and reason, passionate about the divine spark that they believed was to be found within each person and which enables each of us to find truth and meaning without dictates from the established church. 3 weeks ago here, I talked about ethics, where they come from, particularly where we get our personal code of ethics, whether or not this personal code changes over the years. I talked about ethical dilemmas and how we sort these out, how we arrive at decisions that are complex. If you were here on that mid-July Sunday, you may remember that I mentioned a famous study called Heinz's Dilemma. Lawrence Kohlberg is the one who did the Heinz Dilemma study. Heinz steals medicine from a drugstore because he can't afford to buy the medicine, but his wife will die if she doesn't get the medicine. The ethical dilemma is between stealing and the sanctity of life. Philosopher and feminist Carol Gilligan, a name some of you might recognize, she wrote In a Different Voice. She was a research associate for Kohlberg, and she was also one of his harshest critics. Gilligan said that Kohlberg's approach to this dilemma was wrong because, among other things, he only used males in his study, in his research. Gilligan argued that men and women have different value orientations. She was interested only in, Kohlberg was interested only in freedom of choice and what rights the individual has. But Gilligan argues that what matters in Heinz's dilemma is relationships and that choices have to be made based on caring. And then she went on and gave preteen girls this dilemma and preteen boys and came out with totally different answers. Most of the boys said it was okay to steal the money because the wife would die otherwise and you could get more money, but you couldn't get another wife. Now that's good reasoning. But the girls didn't even think about that. They said, no, he shouldn't steal the money because she'd probably need more medicine. And then what? And what if he got caught and he got put in jail? What would happen to the marriage if he stole the money? Wasn't there another way to get money for this drug? And shouldn't Heinz and his wife be trying to figure that out? So is Heinz's dilemma about rights or about our responsibilities to others? I was hoping on that July Sunday to leave you with more questions than answers, and I am aiming for that again today. As I said in those earlier reflections, having grown up in the Presbyterian traditions, I was pretty steeped in the concept of predestination, which I never quite believed. And once I was old enough to begin thinking rationally and maybe reasonably, I'd say around 10, 11, 12 years of age, I just ignored predestination. As I said to you before, if God has already decided who's going to heaven and who's going to that other place, well, why bother to be good? I've never received a satisfactory answer to this question, and I've asked many Presbyterian ministers this. I think the question is more intriguing and meaningful than the one that all of us probably have gotten. If you atheists, agnostics, humanists, Unitarian Universalists in general, if you don't believe in God or some higher authority, then why bother to be good? What is it that underpins our ethics and our morals if we don't believe that we humans answer to a higher authority? Well, in trying to understand my own code of ethics and how I arrived at it, I think that I went through three stages. First, using reason as a basis for what I believed was morally acceptable. Then I could go on to the second stage, which was trying to be rational in every situation. And finally, I hope I have entered a third stage, reverence. I have not discarded reason nor rationality. I'm trying to integrate the three elements, reason, rationalism, and reverence. In July, I asked you these questions. Nobody chose to try to answer any of them, but maybe later. Is Western civilization becoming more and more secular, despite all the religious fanaticism and extremism, or perhaps because of it? As nations and societies become more secular, does it necessarily follow that values, ethics, and morals get lost by the wayside? As fewer and fewer people go to church, and I'm talking about moderate church, mainstream church, certainly not the right side of the spectrum. Does it necessarily follow that, as fewer and fewer people go to church, does it follow that more and more people are only out for themselves? That money and the acquisition of things become more and more important? Does it follow that the importance of money and material possessions increase as the number of people attending mainstream churches decreases? I don't know. It often seems that way to me. I am not saying that secularization is a good or a bad thing. However, I believe that it has created a vacuum, and that concerns me. What rushes in to fill the vacuum? Within this vacuum, where and how do ethics fit? Rebecca Parker talks about putting love first. She doesn't mean self-love. She means love of the whole of creation, love for the interdependent web of which we are a part. She means love and reverence. A love that, in being part of the world view, our worldview, a love that would prevent, possibly, I should probably say could prevent, many of the kinds of tragedies that we have been experiencing from 9/11 to the present. As Unitarian Universalist minister Richard Gilbert says, the traditional Western view of ethics stresses obedience of rules or adherence to principles. Some consider this view too narrow and think that the real focus of morality is the bonding quality of relationships. And some of you may remember that he added this to that statement. In general, men view morality in terms of rights, and women view morality in terms of relationships. I often refer to this as being in right relationship, compassionately connected. In July, I said that an extreme example of not being in right relationship would be the relationship between a Nazi SS soldier and a prisoner in a concentration camp. And I mentioned the word, you're gonna have to help me again, Mitleid, M-I-T-L-E-I-D? Mitleid. which the philosopher Schopenhauer defines as compassion and maybe more specifically, suffering with. I think it maybe compassion is, it's easy to have if you just won the U.S. Open or something, tennis, not golf. But suffering with, I said this in July, to me that word, which like many words in other languages, may be hard to translate into English completely, but I think this concept of suffering with means a lot more and goes deeper than the one I grew up with as a Presbyterian, not one word though, the phrase, walking in someone else's shoes. Mitleid, suffering with, is the compassion that Lucia K.B. Hall says forms the foundation of ethics. Now, I didn't have time three weeks ago to do any more than tell you about Simon Wiesenthal being asked to go see a SS soldier who was dying. They were all in a concentration camp, but the soldier had been, he wasn't in the part where he was being tortured and everything. And as far as I can determine, Wiesenthal was chosen at random. He was relatively healthy in this camp. He was one of the few who got to go outside the camp to work, and they could often find some food that way. So he reluctantly went into this room, and the soldier told him a horrible story about something he had done. And he was dying, as I said, and he wanted Wiesenthal's forgiveness. And Wiesenthal wrestled with this for the few minutes he was in the room, and he could not do it. He could not give that soldier Wiesenthal's forgiveness. The next day he ran into a nurse who said that the soldier, had died during the night, and she had a very small packet of the soldier's belongings, and she wanted Wiesenthal to take it, and he refused. But he did note the address of the soldier's mother. And after the war, maybe as much as a couple years after the war, Wiesenthal went to Stuttgart, and reluctantly, again, he wasn't sure what was drawing him, but he went to the mother's house and he met her. And this area of Stuttgart was bombed out, and the woman had lost her husband as well as her only son in the war. His name, the only son's name, was Karl. But it turned out that Karl's father was a social democrat. He was opposed to the Nazis. He did not want his son to join the Hitler Youth. He was very disappointed in his son. The woman kept telling Wiesenthal what a wonderful son Karl had been. What a kind boy. What a wonderful boy. And Wiesenthal, on the spot, made up a story about how he knew Karl, the soldier. He could not bring himself to tell the mother the truth about what her son had done. And Wiesenthal asks, at the end of relating all of this, what link was there between me, who might have been among her son's victims, and her, a lonely woman grieving for this son of her family, living in the ruins of her people? Wiesenthal answers his question this way: perhaps the link is grief and sorrow. Mitleid, suffering with. Lucia Hall wrote this in a humanist magazine: ethics cannot be derived from religious authority or from reason, but is biologically based in empathy, biologically based in empathy, ethics. And something fell into place for me, because there it is, that third note in my search for a basis of ethical moral harmony that is not derived from a higher outside authority. Biologically based in empathy, reverence. Hall goes on to say, this ability to feel as another person feels, to be able to put yourself in their emotional situation, even to wince involuntarily when someone bangs their funny bone, this is the link that binds the human race together. that makes us care about how we act toward others. End of quote. This ability is rooted in reverence. I believe that a personal code of ethics must involve transcending boundaries. Shortly before I left on the trip to Transylvania, I read an amazing book because I'd had it on hold and there it was, you know, the library called. I thought this book was for adults because I saw it advertised in the New Yorker. It had to be for adults, right? I hadn't gotten very far into it when I realized that it was a book for younger readers. But everyone should read this book. It is all about transcending boundaries, making connections, and being in right relationship. And it's funny. And I'm always looking for laughs. But it will bring tears to your eyes as well. Rainy Nightingale is the title of the book by Kate DiCamillo. Some of you may know that name. She writes children's books and young adult books. There is a great deal of wrestling with ethical behavior in this book. The wrestling is done by 3 10-year-old girls. Well, at that age, children are generally logical thinkers. They don't do much nuanced thinking. Morals and ethics are black and white. Gray doesn't interest them yet or factor into their thought processes. But 10-year-olds also have an abundance of reverence for life. All three of the protagonists are dealing with crises in their lives. Adult-generated crises. Ethical dilemmas abound and confront them every day. One of the girls, Rainy, spends a lot of time trying to figure out exactly what a good deed is, and then trying to actually successfully perform one. At one point, an elderly woman tells Rainy, who's trying to read to her, "I am not interested in people doing good deeds. Good deeds are pointless. In any case, nothing changes, nothing matters." There was much more to my Presbyterian upbringing than the predestination part. There was a strong connection to Jesus as a compassionate connector, as a human being who understood that compassionate connections are what will save humanity, that our ethics have to ultimately be about relationship, not about rights and principles. I agree with Rebecca Parker, who said that our society is currently guided by a worldview that is insufficiently grounded in reverence. She is not saying that our society needs to be more religious. She is saying we need to be more reverent. Those two are not the same thing. Reverence is profound respect mingled with love and awe. There's no use of the word God in there. This is from the dictionary. I would add profound respect of life mingled with love and awe. What we need, Parker maintains, is a revolution in values. Reverence is a form of love. But here's what particularly struck me in Parker's statements, this one. Reverence for life has to be learned. Can reverence for life be learned? Doesn't that imply that we can change human nature? I hate the phrase, "Oh, that's just human nature." I really hate that phrase because to me it's a cop-out. It says, well, we can't, we humans, you know, we try, but we really can't make the world a better place. We haven't ended war or poverty, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because they're just human nature. Can we switch our Western code of ethics from one based on rights and property and rules and regulations to one based mainly on relationships and caring? To be in right relationship, you have to be aware of the world and aware of your place in it. Can people learn this kind of awareness, this level of awareness? Not long ago, I came across what, for me, is a timely quote from the Russian novel Brothers Karamazov by Fyodor Dostoevsky. I may have used this in July, but it's worth repeating. Not all are guilty, but all are responsible. This quote has helped me grapple with some of the tragedy of the past few months, Orlando, St. Paul, Dallas, just to name a few, because if we can grasp that concept, not all are guilty, but all are responsible, perhaps we can move past those things that prevent us from acting, not only guilt, but also frustration over the immensity of the problems we humans face. Perhaps we can learn to be more reverent and more passionate. Reverence is waking up each morning profoundly grateful, full of a profound respect mingled with love and awe. You know, some of you don't like mornings, so you can postpone that past the time when the sun rises if you need to. It's over there, east. This is not easy or automatic for me. Not yet, I'm working on it. It takes effort and awareness. But as some of you know, on Memorial Day weekend, a close friend of mine died suddenly in her sleep at age 64. Reverence is waking up each morning profoundly grateful, full of a profound respect mingled with love and awe. As Bird Baylor reminds us in that story I used, the way to start a day, a morning needs to be sung to, a new day needs to be honored. People have always known that. Since the beginning of time, people have known that. And the fact that we know, or we think we know, so much more in the 21st century than our cave brothers and sisters, that fact doesn't change anything when it comes to celebrating a new day and raising your arms to the sun. Giving thanks for the sunrise is not a rebuke of or a contradiction to science, to reason, to rationality, but rather another aspect of being human. Reverence is being astounded by the passion of others, those who go over and over and over again to the social action, social justice meetings, such as Moses. Reverence is being patient in the face of foolishness and distractions in an election year because of that profound respect for life mingled with awe and love. Reverence is a profound respect for others when encountering another person in a totally different culture, in a totally different setting, and really, really, truly keeping your mouth shut and listening to them and not being worried about being rational or reasonable and definitely not being concerned about the need to be right, as in correct. Reverence is grieving for all of the needless tragic deaths of black men by the police in this country. Reverence is also grieving when the police are ambushed and tragically killed for no reason. Reverence is found in the faces of the Transylvanian people in the village of Nojoita, waving and waving to us Americans and the three Indians who were with us as we left their village after having traveled so long and so far to meet these brothers and sisters of ours. Reverence is empathy and mitleid, suffering with. Beware of politicians who do not have empathy. Can we be rational and reasonable and reverent all at once? Can we listen to our hearts as well as our heads? Our job is to embody all three elements, all three notes, reason, rationality, reverence, and to continue to carry on the tradition of free thought and love of life handed down to us by so many people, including those long ago Transylvanians. Our job, in the words of Rebecca Parker, is to make love the first, not the last resort. This is an audacious task, she says, for a small movement of progressive people of faith. But to paraphrase Thomas Stark King, we may be small, but when we are mad, we weigh a ton. The weight of our passionate caring can help turn the world around. We are an ethical, moral people, whether or not we believe in a higher authority or believe that our moral character derives from within us because there is a spark of the divine within each of us. Reverence is for all of us, atheists, humanists, agnostics, Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, Jews, Hindus, pagans, Wiccans, pantheists, our Transylvanian Unitarian cousins, all of us. Put reverence with reason and rationality, and you get a very special blend of compassion, a unique lens through which to view the world. You get three-part harmony. Closing words are by Unitarian Universalist Minister Kenneth Collier. I sit in my garden and contemplate the depth and profundity of the universe. And all the while, the wind blows gently from the hills and teases the leaves and flowers and brushes my hair. A hummingbird visits the bright red sage, and gnats hover in the warm air. What need is there of profundity? Everything I need is here. Go in peace, greet your neighbor, drink iced coffee.